Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest to you. He is Dr. Kurt Newman, who is the president and CEO of Children's National Health System, which is in Washington, D.C., and has been consistently ranked as one of the best pediatric hospitals in the country. Dr. Newman, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Now, Dr. Newman, you wear more than one hat, although president and CEO of Children's National seems like quite enough, but you are also a professor of surgery and pediatrics at George Washington University School of Medicine, correct?
That's right. I have been part of the teaching faculty at George Washington for almost 30 years now. It's one of the great pleasures to work with young people and students, particularly medical students, around their careers in my case, pediatric medicine.
Well, speaking of students as they are beginning their careers, for those listening who perhaps are medical students, what is, do you think, something important for them to recognize as they choose to pursue their medical career? I know that's a broad question, but it gives you lots of latitude to answer.
Sure. Most of my career was as a pediatric surgeon, a practicing pediatric surgeon, taking care of children and families. I only became CEO 6 years ago, so that's really what I've spent most of my life doing. And I remember as I was getting into medical school, and I went to a great medical school down at Duke, I had no idea what I would later learn of just all the different opportunities there are in medicine. And it's just become more and more evident to me as I've been in medicine, just there's so many different ways that you can make a contribution, whether it's practice, whether it's research, whether it's business. The sky is wide open for that type of opportunity, and you can change, you can be flexible. And I didn't know when I started out that I would end up being a CEO of a hospital. And even when I was practicing surgery, I didn't know I'd go that route. But that's one of the great things I think about a career in medicine. There's just tremendous and terrific opportunities. And, as you go along, I think it's great to be open to those opportunities. Another thing I'd say is to be open to mentors and to look for mentors. And that served me well. And I talk about that in my book, about some of the great mentors I had that helped guide my career and things I learned from them and how they helped shepherd me along to make choices, decisions, learn lessons, and really become first a good doctor and then a surgeon and then now a CEO of one of the great children's hospitals.
Your book, which is entitled Healing Children, is subtitled A Surgeon's Stories from the Frontiers of Pediatric Medicine. And you say very early on that you were surprised at how few hospitals there are that are specifically dedicated to the care of children, which I actually didn't realize at all. So I was surprised to read that.
Well, yes, that was something I didn't know when I started out, and certainly things have changed a little bit from when I started out 40 years ago. But it was a whole world of pediatric medicine specialists, children's hospitals, that wasn't as obvious and it wasn't as a clear-cut opportunity as a lot of the other specialties that I encountered. So it was a more than pleasant surprise when I did discover that world at one of the great children's hospitals at Boston Children's and just learned the special value of pediatric medicine and specialists and this world that was where kids were the primary focus. And that's what I got inspired by and decided to make my career into pediatric medicine, and in my case, pediatric surgery. And it's just been a consistent exciting challenge and opportunity to be a part of that. So that's why I wrote the book, was to tell these stories from my own career to help people understand, parents and people in general, just that special value so that they could seek that out and to help people and empower them to learn about this world that I know that maybe a lot of people don't know.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I have to agree with you that there is more attention paid in a lot of ways to adult diseases and adult care than to children's care. I didn't realize the rift, if you will, was so large. You say, again, and this is early on in Healing Children, that in the United States there are 35 independent children's hospitals, more than 200 operating as part of a larger integrated healthcare system. So, you know, those numbers by themselves, okay, not so bad. But when you compare that up against the 5,000 hospitals that focus primarily on adult care, it seems to me that you are underscoring how great the need is for more pediatric physicians and certainly more pediatric surgeons.
I think that's right. And, you know, those statistics are what they are, statistics, and they give you some sense of the imbalance. But it's just an incredible paradox or irony to me that, you know, at a time when we really are thinking about children and their our future, we're not investing as much as we ought to. And whether it's insurance coverage or research or finding the best care, you know, it just seems a little bit upside down to me. I think we ought to be putting more into our kids, and whether it's pediatric specialists, children's hospitals, research into their diseases, or in some of the recent policy debates, you didn't hear much about children, but the impact of those decisions would have been huge on our children. So that's not to say that that's why I wrote the book, but I really do want to help spark a wider conversation about that, because I think there's so much more we can do, and I think it's wise medicine. It's a good investment.
And it makes complete sense. I mean, we know intellectually that children are our future. Operationally, sometimes it seems as though we forget that, or at least don't honor it enough as we need to. In Healing Children, you begin with a somewhat stunning story of a 4-year-old patient by the name of Ella. Can you tell us a little bit about Ella and her family?
Sure. Well, this was when I was a resident, and I was on rounds, and I was, you know, I was learning to be a surgeon, and I was with a group of surgeons and a chief resident in particular, and we were learning adult surgery, and we had been we were doing our rotation at a children's hospital, and the environment there was just so different at the children's hospital from the adult hospital, and really. I told this story to illustrate. There was this patient-centeredness and family focus at the time that I hadn't really encountered before, and it struck me. And on this one instance, this little girl had surgery, and she had a tube that was needed to be in her stomach that goes through her nose, called a nasogastric tube, to help her recover from the surgery. Now, this can look just frightful to the, you know, a layperson, and certainly to a child. But as a doctor, you know, we were kind of used to these things and didn't pay much attention to it. My boss at the time, when he was asked about it, the tube and how could it, the family was asking how could we make it easier or better or for her not to feel so different or weird. He basically just blew that off because it was just part of the treatment, and we needed to move on. And it kind of, you know, that kind of stuck with me until I came back the next day with him on rounds and the family. decided to take things into their own hands, and I walked into the room, and every family member had taped a tube to their nose to make it look like they had a tube that went down into their stomach, so that the child felt like this was just part of the routine and made her feel like there was nothing different about her, and would help her, and that would help her recovery and her healing. So my boss, he was kind of annoyed and, you know, kind of stormed out of the room. Whereas I was looking at that, I thought, yeah, you know, that's kind of a cool idea. And I can see why they do that. Now, that kind of thing takes a lot of extra time, and it's not, you know, you don't get paid for that type of interaction with patients and families. But when you step back and look at it, boy, that was really, an innovative thing for that family to do. And that's just kind of the difference that I've seen all along the way, is that when it comes to children and you're dealing with pediatric specialists and people that understand children and think about their development, they're not just thinking about the problem that they have right there in front of them that day, the immediate problem. They're thinking, too, not only that, but what's the next day and what's the future look like and what impact that I do today is going to have on the future. So if I'm taking care of a broken bone, I'm thinking about how that bone and that leg are going to heal, not just now, but how that's going to impact with growth, with playing sports, with what that child is going to need to do as an adult. So it's this forward thinking. And that is particularly true when we think about the brain and the development of children and how, for example, a concussion in an 8-year-old is just so different than a 12-year-old or 16-year-old or 20-year-old, because we're talking about a potential brain injury, but it's not just the impact right now, but it's how that brain is going to develop, how that child is going to develop as they go along. So that's the perspective that I've seen with pediatric specialists, with children's hospitals, and it's just a whole different world.
Is it possible for one to learn empathy as one is going about one's work with children or just in their life, do you believe? Or if you either you have it or you don't. What's your thought?
Well, I think it's probably a mix. I think everybody has deep empathy within them. I think every person I've ever met or known has there's something there that they want to help others. They want to be kind to others. I think over time, some people lose sight of that or track of that. And I think, for example, my goal as CEO, and I've seen it over and over again, is to tap into people's natural empathy and the empathy they come with. For some, it's easier than others. But I think there are ways to, when I say tap into it, I mean, unleash it and educate and help guide people that it's okay and it's, you know, that it's important. Some people are better than others. And those are the kind of people that I think are attracted to a children's hospital, because they almost always have a special spot in their heart for kids. They love children and they want to give back.
What is the particular challenge to you, if there is one, as you spend so much of your surgical career working with children, when you had a child, a little one, that you knew that you could only do so much for and that you might not be able to prolong their lives or to alleviate the issue that brought them into the hospital? What was that like for you?
Very tough. Probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with. And I tell this story in the book about a family who was friends of mine and had a baby. And it was very jarring, because as I saw them, and I didn't realize that they were bringing their baby in at the hospital, that I was going to be the one that was taking care of their baby. And I just had this whole decision-making with myself where I kind of didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be in the situation of having to work with them and maybe even have to tell them that there was nothing more we could do. Now, my boss at the time and mentor, Dr. Randolph, turned it around on me. And he said, look, you know, nobody in the world is going to give that baby and this family better care than you are. And they know that and they believe that. And if things don't work out well, there won't ever be a day that they aren't happy that they had you take care of their baby, because they know, they'll know that everything was done. And so that gave me sort of the liberty and courage, if you will, to go back and take care of my friends and their baby. It didn't turn out the way we all would have wanted. He had an incurable disease. They took it with as much serenity and courage as anybody I've ever seen. This mother was the kind of person that she wanted to make sure everybody else was taken care of before she worried about herself. So it was, you know, one of those things. I learned that I had maybe gone against the grain in the classical teaching, which is what my mentor had helped me do, which was that it would be okay to take care of your friends, that you wouldn't get so emotionally attached that you would lose the appropriate decision making, which you do have to be careful about, but that it would give them great peace going forward. And so that I changed my whole style and practice around that, and over the years took care of many children that were friends of mine. And you know, it did put extra pressure on the situation, but it was also a very satisfying part of it. So years later, When I was writing the book, I got back in touch with my friends and I shared the story, and they hadn't really heard the part about my mentor before. And I shared that with them through this story, and they wrote back to me and said, you know, that was exactly right. Your boss, Dr. Randolph, was exactly right. We were so glad that it was you and that you were there and that you took care of our son. And you know, in many ways, that was healing for me, because
absolutely,
it had kind of been something I'd never really directly addressed with them. But it, you know, 30 years later, kind of brought it full circle. And so, you know, it's just one of those things in medicine that, you know, I learned over the years, but just made it so rewarding, even though it was one of the most difficult things I ever had to deal with.
I can't even begin to imagine what that would be like. What's clear, though, is that Dr. Randolph was a huge impact and a positive impact on your life. Dr. Newman, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with the time that Dr. Randolph asked you to evaluate Jessica. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. I'm having a conversation with Dr. Kirk Newman, who is the author of Healing Children, A Surgeon's Stories from the Frontiers of Pediatric Medicine. We'll be back in just a moment. There were many things in Healing Children that surprised me. not the least of which was the story that you shared when Dr. Randolph asked you to evaluate Jessica to see if anything had been missed in her treatment. Can you tell us about that time?
Sure. I think one of the great things about my training was to have somebody like Dr. Randolph, who was a little bit unconventional and I wouldn't say a maverick, but he liked to just take a different look at things at times and not just rely on conventional wisdom. And one of his, I think, great strengths was not was to be humble and not to. So here's one of the greatest surgeons of all time, greatest pediatric surgeons, first pediatric full-time pediatric surgeon in Washington, D.C. And so I had joined the hospital to do a two-year fellowship to learn about pediatric surgery because we train first in adult general surgery and then you do a specific training. And so there was a baby who'd been born who had a very complicated problem and had had surgery. And but just was not able to digest food, had been born with a blockage, at least, or actually two blockages, and had just never been able to digest food. And there was no easy answer. And all the tests came up negative. It looked like everything was open. There was no reason for the food not to go through. And her mother would be there every day, and we'd all just be hoping that things would move through and open up. And I had not been present at the first surgery and was new to the team. And about a couple of months after I'd been there, I think, you know, everybody was getting frustrated. Dr. Randolph had been called in to consult on the case. And he turned to me as basically, here I am, really a rookie, and said, why don't you take a look at things with a fresh set of eyes and, you know, go back to the beginning, you know, start as if you're getting this case, this baby's case, fresh, and don't let any of what's happened color your opinions. And so I did that and, you know, was just kind of looking through things and went back to the original notes in the of the operation. And because the baby had had two blockages, there was this just really rare, unusual scenario that what if the intestine hadn't twisted around, and there's this whole embryologic thing that, you know, that's pretty detailed, but hadn't twisted around, and things were sewn in backwards. And what if that was accounting for the fact that the baby was acting like she had a blockage? And so I took that idea to one of our great x-ray doctors, radiologists, and to his credit, he didn't think I was crazy and said, well, we could do this test and see if your theory might be right. Sure enough, we did the test, and it looked like that things were going shooting up the backwards the wrong way. And I took that to Dr. Randolph, and he didn't blink an eye. He was so, I think, pleased that we had come up with a solution. And so we went ahead, and based on that, he took my theory, which had been now confirmed by the x-ray, but explained it to the family. They were wonderful about it, and we went back and did the surgery, corrected the situation, and I mean, it was an amazing day when Jessica started eating and then had her first poop. And the mother was so happy. I talk about it in the book, but she wanted to bronze that thing. And we were just so thrilled. And I've reconnected with Jessica around the writing of the book. I followed her for years and years. And we just had, it was just hugs all around. And one of the things that I loved about it was that she, as a baby, had had no idea, of course, that how intense and caring her mother had been, and how her mother had been at her bedside day in, day out for, you know, it, while in the hospital, at least a year, if not more. And that just, it was just a, you know, a dimension of her life that I could share with her through this book. And it, for her, it was incredibly healing to see that picture of her mom as a young mother who was just desperate for her little baby to get well and, you know, do the things that all the children do. And, you know, that's one of those things, too. It's a theme in the book, is just the incredible resilience of children. I mean, you just can't underestimate what they can. You don't want to put them to the test if you don't have to, but just their incredible ability to reach their full potential. And that's what pediatric medicine specialists, children's hospitals are all about, to help children reach that potential.
There was also something pretty extraordinary about Dr. Randolph. What is Dr. Randolph's first name?
Judson.
Judson.
And his friends and people called him Judd. He asked me to call him Judd once I joined the staff, and I was probably in my mid-30s. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't call him Judd. He was always Dr. Randolph to me until I turned 50, and he said, when you turn 50, you got to call me Judd. So I remember calling him up, and I kind of croaked out, you know, Judd, you know, like that. And once I did it once, then I could do it. But it never felt quite right. He was really, for me, always Dr. Randolph.
Well, one of the, for me, extraordinary things about Dr. Randolph was, and it's around the Jessica situation, when Dr. Randolph told the parents that he was upset with himself for failing to realize what had happened. And the first thing I thought was, well, wasn't he worried about a lawsuit? Nowadays,
you know,
lawsuits are on everybody's mind.
I think he had the kind of relationships with people that really didn't enter his mind. He didn't practice defensive medicine or any, you know, which is what people call it now. He would just try and do the right thing. He was honest, humble. When or if he made a mistake, he would, you know, be straight up about it. And he built these relationships with families that stood the test of time, and they understood he was doing his best, and that, and I think they, you know, gave him the benefit of the doubt on that, and, you know, that was one of those times, and it's something I learned from him, and he just had this incredible humility. I mean, it was inspiring to be around him.
The insistence that psychiatrists be included on cases that might impact a child's self-esteem, is that something that occurs today at Children's?
You know, I think there's so much greater awareness of mental and behavioral health issues now than was evident back when Dr. Randolph was practicing. So it was almost revolutionary that he included a psychiatrist, a psychiatric social worker, child life on his rounds, particularly with children on the burn unit. He had a really special interest in children who had suffered burn injuries. And so he would make rounds with this multidisciplinary team. I was used to rounds being made with a group of surgeons, and we talk about the surgical problems and, you know, deal with those. So it was a little weird, to be honest, when I encountered this approach, this very senior and well-known surgeon who was including all of these other disciplines on his rounds, but I grew to understand what he was trying to do. Now that's become much more commonplace, and I think there's a much larger appreciation of the impact of hospitalization, of injuries, of surgery, of the and the emotional needs and developmental needs of children. So in the hospitals these days, I mean, you see art, you see music, you see clowns, you see all sorts of different ways of helping children and families deal with the issues they personally have or being in the hospital. And there's a lot more resources around there, around the psychology and maybe even psychiatric needs of children. I mean, the other view on that is just the mental health issues of children these days. And it's hard to separate out the physical from the emotional, from the mental health. But 20% of children will have some type of mental health or behavioral health issue while they're children. And many of those are undiagnosed and undiagnosed for long periods of time until they get treatment. So there's this whole, dimension of need that children and families have that can be as well exacerbated by a hospitalization. So we've tried to do a better job of being in tune with that and having resources for those kids. I've had a special focus on children with autism that need hospitalization, and that wrote about a story about that in the book, because when I became CEO, I had a mother who got pretty angry with me, a friend of mine, because we weren't really set up to, as a children's hospital, to take care of kids with autism, not necessarily for their autism needs, but for their other health care needs. And it was, she was right when I looked into it and I realized that we weren't coordinating things well. We were probably making it worse for kids with autism with the way we were setting up their experiences in the hospital, that people weren't trained, and that there was so much we could do to make it better. And so, I took that on as a personal goal and worked on it, created a position of a nurse navigator to help those families. And we've really, I feel like, made a difference. And that same mother has come up to me a couple times now to tell me what a difference it makes, so that her child, when they know he's coming in, he's got the things that make him happy ready. And the things that, whether it's somebody blowing bubbles, or whether it's his special toy or a particular piece of music he likes, we have all that ready for him so that he feels comfortable, as opposed to an alien environment that's scary, that may trigger off a lot of behaviors, because it's just not the safe and comfortable scenario that he's used to. And so as I think about our hospital in general, we've tried to create those types of experiences for everybody. And whether it's, having psychiatrists on rounds like we started the conversation with, or whether it's having more music or more art, or we've got a TV studio in our atrium where we produce shows for the kids and that kind of thing. All of that, to be as creative and innovative as we can be to make a child's experience a healing experience in the hospital.
The fact that you are so keenly aware of the impact of the child's mental health on his or her physical health and of the families is just so important. And it takes me to a concern, which is probably a conversation for another day, but a concern about insurance and the way in which insurances are perhaps moving towards treating mental health care and the services that they will cover in the mental health care spectrum.
It's something that's so frustrating. You're right. I don't know that we have enough time to talk about. But why is it, when we're talking about our children's brains and their development and their mental health, that we treat things differently, or we pay for the care differently In fact, you could argue we ought to be paying more for it and reimburse at a higher rate for that, because it's just such an important part of a child's life and personality and a family's life. So it's, you know, that is so, it not only frustrates me, but I get angry about it. And there's just so many things that get in the way of good conversation about it, because there's this stigma that I think kind of just is over the whole problem and the whole issue, that people don't like to necessarily talk about it. The health policy is wrong. We're not training enough psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health providers. We're not doing enough research into those problems. And yet the promise is so great, and because we're unlocking all these mysteries of the brain, genetics, we've got imaging. There's so many things coming along. There's so much we could do, yet we're kind of just caught still in this approach of, well, there's something really different and we don't want to talk about it. And, you know, we're just not doing the right thing. And so, you know, I want to turn that around. I want to find a way and ways that we can talk about it. Because I think what we're going to find out, that each mental health issue is going to be a collection of a lot of different diseases, and it's going to be, you know, Johnny's specific genetic issue or Susie's, and we've been lumping all these things together, and when we tease them apart, we're going to find, boy, that was the wrong approach. And if we specifically look at this personal issue and this their personal genetics, and we're going to find that we're going to be able to solve a lot of things that we've been unable to do just because we've lumped it all together and don't quite have a strong approach on how to treat the individual. So I am, at the one time, on the one hand, kind of not necessarily, well, maybe upset and frustrated, but on the other hand, I'm very, very optimistic that when we put our attention to it, we put our resources to it, we're going to be able to make some big breakthroughs and really help a lot of kids and a lot of families.
The idea that some people have, I was about to say many, and I'm hoping that it's less, that if it's a mental health issue, it's all in your head and you can make it go away, that you created it, you inserted it in there somehow, and somehow you can just pull it out of your head and pull yourself up together and get yourself going, is such a wrong and simplistic view of the power of our psychological sense of self, that I'm absolutely with you. The more that we pay attention to the emotional and the psychological experiences of children and their families, the better we will be as a country, the healthier we will be as a country, both emotionally and physically. Dr. Duma, there are so many things that we could say as we have a conversation about the mental health needs of children and their families. And one of the points that you make is that children very often don't receive the mental health assistance that they need, in part because families are in denial. Families are saying it's not that big a deal, or it's not real, or it's not a problem. How do we approach that with the families?
Well, Dr. Brewer, you're spot on with that. And one of the things I wanted to do in writing Healing Children was to help parents and, you know, understand how they can get help and become advocates, and how important that is, not to underestimate the situation, but that with early diagnosis and early intervention, there's so many things that can help children. And that can be physically, but it's even more, I think, with, as you point out, with the mental and behavioral health. I think that's where it comes. And so some of the ways that you can become empowered and advocate is around the others that are working with your children, whether it's the teachers and pediatricians. And I make a strong case for just that old school type of pediatrician that was that knew the family, knew the children, and was a trusted resource, a safe place that a parent could go. But it's one of those things to not be scared, and if you see something that just doesn't feel right, to bring it to someone's attention. And that's how we'll get past this stigma, because when you do that, you're giving your child a chance. You're giving them a chance to get the right treatment. And so many of these things can be treated, whether, and frequently when they're treated early, as I said before, the results are so much better. I think the statistic is, though, that it's 8 years from when somebody first notices that there's something not quite right, or that there's a some type of sign or symptom, till when a child gets treated for a mental or behavioral health issue. Just think about what could be happening during that 8 years to lessen the pain and the trauma and of what may be very difficult to deal with later. And then there's a whole concept that I think we're starting to understand and see is our ability, if we're picking up things early, that we're going to be able to avoid some of the adult chronic diseases.
Yes.
That could be the mental health issues, or it could be diabetes or heart disease. And with the testing that's coming along and the genetics and new treatments, boy, do we want to be sure that we're getting those diagnoses as early as possible to avoid those potential problems later.
Dr. Newman, I understand that you have helped to create the Institute for Pediatric Surgical Innovation, and its primary focus is making children's surgery less invasive and more pain-free. Do you have a thought about the long-term impact of the NICU experience for babies who are subjected to so many painful procedures?
Sure. Great question. And one of the, as the chief of surgery at Children's National and having practiced surgery so many years, I was challenged by one of my mentors, Joe Robert. And I was at the point that I was had thought, well, you know, we've really created a great program here, one of the world's great centers for surgery for children in the world. And he challenged me. He said, you know, look, you've done a lot of great stuff, and you really are at the forefront now, but where are you going to be 10, 15, 20 years from now? What are you doing now that's going to make that make a difference for children 10, 15, 20 years from now, and is going to change surgery on children? And boy, that was just a totally different way of looking at things. And I thought, well, as I did research on it and, you know, really try to understand what the trends are, it really came down to thinking about surgically differently and thinking about it from the child's perspective. And what was really going to make a difference was, in one case, I think, getting the technology for children, specific for children, because most of the time we have been using technology that was adapted from adult technology. So tools, instruments, imaging, everything was adapted from adults. So why not have things specific for children? So that was one. And the second was around pain, because children, the pain score, for example, as being, which is asking children, you know, to point their finger at whether it was a smiley face or a frowny face, and trying to, you know, do a scientific approach using that, although it was a good start, really didn't allow for any type of breakthroughs or specific treatments around pain. We needed to develop an objective measure of pain, so that then we could find the whether it's medications, techniques, whatever it was that could help children with pain. So those were the two main principles I wanted to build into this institute, and we got a great gift to get the institute started, and we've been moving along. I'd say our progress has been stronger on the technology side of it. We've spun off 14 or 15 companies of different ideas and patents to help with the tools and the technology for pediatric surgery. I'd say the pain has been more difficult. It was a deeper challenge than I thought. And although we're making progress, it just can't be fast enough. I think, though, what we've really learned and made some progress in is thinking about children, and this may just sound so logical, but just thinking about employing some of the things that children like to do in the treatment and in the evaluation of their pain. And the one example I'd use for that is using how children like to play games and building games around their trying to figure out their pain, and so that they don't even know when you're evaluating them. They think they're playing a game, but actually what you're doing is you're evaluating how they're moving as they try and dodge things, or maybe ride a simulated horse, or drive a jet plane. They're not thinking that they're moving their arms or they're moving their legs or they're doing different things. But meanwhile, we're evaluating all of that and can make the game harder so that they have to do more. What they're doing is having fun as a child, and they're not thinking about the pain or the discomfort. If they're coming into the medical environment and they have a doctor, you know, pulling or pushing on something and asking them, does this hurt? Does that hurt? And trying to get a real feel for things, that, you know, doesn't go that well for very long. And then the next time they come, they're not going to want to do it at all. And so we've really tried to incorporate that type of thinking and think about things through the eyes of a child to build our therapeutic approach and our diagnostic approach. I wish we could do more and move even faster there, but I do foresee a day where we are able to really minimize the pain, if not eliminate it. And, you know, I wish I could practice in that environment, because that's one of the hardest things, is to see children in pain. And I think any doctor or nurse or, you know, knows that and feels it. And it's one of the hardest parts of the job.
I would also think that it would be that much more difficult with children who have been traumatized and learned to be silent about the pain, whether it's been an overt demand that they say nothing, or just through their environment they've learned that articulating an awareness of their pain is just not going to work for them. It's just going to be more harmful than helpful. And so for those children, that much more difficult to understand what the true pain quotient is for them.
Absolutely right. And that's where the objective measure of pain, maybe it's, you know, a set of brain waves or a certain biological marker, we can get past that whole set of challenges about. And that's why I'm so intent on being able to measure it objectively. And then there are, you know, we deal with a lot of children that couldn't tell you anyway because they're babies.
Right.
And how do we know what they're perceiving and whether their biology might be completely different on how the medications might affect them, or different experiences affect them? We make a set of assumptions, but what we learn over and over again is what's true for, say, a newborn may not be true for a fetus. And, you know, we're doing a lot of procedures and things now in on the fetal side of things. So that's a whole new landscape of medicine, or a toddler or a teenager. And we just can't lump it all together. So that's why I think getting to a measure, and we're making progress there, and then I think we'll be able to make a lot of faster advances, because I'll be able to, or any doctor, it'll be like a vital sign, like a pulse, blood pressure, and what's your, you know, pain measurement. I don't think that's far off. And then I think it'll unlock a lot of the things that we just don't know, or we're making good guesses, or and we may find out a lot of things we were just doing it the wrong way and making it worse. And nobody wants to be on that side of things. So I'm really optimistic about that frontier of medicine, but we're not quite there yet.
You offer some concrete, really useful tips for parents, and I'd like to go over a couple of them, but I would just like to sort of close out the pain portion of our conversation, acknowledging what you indicate, which is that chronic pain affects 20 to 35% of children and adolescents. I think so often it's easy for adults to say, he's making it up, she just doesn't want to go to school. 20 to 35% of the child and adolescent population, that's pretty significant.
Right. And, you know, that number may reflect that, you know, at some point during their childhood or their adolescence, they had, you know, a chronic pain experience. And, you know, I think everybody remembers when they, you know, had something that was really going on a long time. And it can be for some children, the defining experience. So that's why I think we're so passionate about trying to get to the bottom of what causes pain, what can we do about it, how do we measure it, so that we can relieve that burden. And back to one of your earlier points, we may not know exactly the true incidence, because in many cases children aren't communicating, or they're babies or infants, or it's just something that, you know, they keep locked inside them. So I think but I'm hopeful, because now there's doctors that are taking this on. There's a whole area of medicine now that focuses on pain, and in particular children's pain. And so I think we're going to see a lot of positive change there. I think it's, but right now it's a, you know, it's a burden. And I think, you know, like with everything, we want our children to not have that type of burden. What I would say, though, on the other side of this question, is that I never also want to underestimate the resilience of the children dealing with it. And it's just incredible what, you know, they can live through and put up with. But then on the other hand, and I tell a story in Healing Children about a girl, and she's an inspiration in another way, not something that she overcame, but how little in the end we were able to do for her pain. We cured her cancer, but we really had left her with pain that, you know, she just you know, just defined her life, and it was tragic. So that's the challenge of dealing with children and families, is that most of the time there's so much you can do. And, you know, people say to me, they say, how can you work at a children's hospital? It must be really depressing and discouraging, all those tough stories. But it's actually anything but. It's inspiring, it's fun, it's happy. We create an environment of just lots of great things for children to experience. There's music, art, light, and so on. But there are these other situations that inspire us in a different way. And that's the great challenge.
Dr. Newman, there's so much more that you share in Healing Children that we don't have time for today. There's just one quick piece of advice that you offer that if you could just very quickly comment on it, I would appreciate it. You recommend that parents take a tour of the nearest children's hospital before they need to take their child there. Why is that?
You know, I have received so many calls over the years of parents that are in a difficult spot, and it's a spot they're in. Maybe it's at a community hospital that doesn't have the pediatric resources or specialists. Maybe it's in an emergency department that doesn't really focus on children, or they're with an anesthesiologist about to have surgery, and the anesthesiologist, you know, really doesn't have a lot of experience with children, and on and on. And so, you know, I've just dealt with this and thought about it so many times over the years that I thought, you know, the time to deal with that, and I really want to help them while they're in that situation, but I know if they knew what I knew and they had sort of knew it ahead of time, maybe they wouldn't be in that situation. So what I advise people is, look, prepare yourself and do some research and plan it out ahead of time as if you think it might happen. Let's hope you're never in a situation for an emergency and your child doesn't fall off a monkey bar and break their arm or have a concussion on the soccer field, or your baby doesn't need to, you know, go to a specialized neonatal intensive care nursery. But the best time to kind of sort some of that out is ahead of time and talk to your pediatrician and take a drive over to where the nearest children's hospital or their nearest pediatric emergency department is. Do it at a time when it's not an emergency, because the worst time is when you're in the midst of an emergency or an urgent situation and you're trying to deal with your child, and who wants to be trying to figure out, you know, the route or what the best place is. And there's also a lot of resources you can unlock ahead of time, and you'll feel comfortable and you'll know, you know, the route, you know where to park, you kind of have a comfort level of what's going to happen. And so I think that if I had one piece of advice to give, I'd give people that advice so that they can be advocates, they feel empowered, they feel confident, because you want to have that. It's your child, and you want to have everything the best for them, and that's one of the ways of getting the best care for your children.
Dr. Kurt Newman, President and CEO of Children's National Health System in Washington, D.C., thank you so much for the work that you do, that you've been doing, that you continue to do. And, of course, thank you for writing Healing Children. It's a wonderful book. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's been great to have the opportunity to speak with you and share some of my ideas from Healing Children with your audience.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. I'd love to hear from you about this or any Mind Talk program. My email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.